I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
This hour, it's Let Me Speak to the Governor. Governor Spencer Cox answers questions from KSL and from you. Call now, 801-575-8255. Let Me Speak to the Governor, live from the studios of KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
And welcome on in to Let Me Speak to the Governor. Today I am Lindsay Ertz, filling in for the vacationing Maria Chaleos. We are going to spend the next hour with Utah's Governor, Governor Spencer Cox, answering your questions, answering our questions about problems, issues, and topics we need to discuss here in the state of Utah. First of all, let me welcome in Governor Spencer Cox. Governor, how are you?
Hey, Lindsay, welcome. It's great to be with you. I miss Maria, but I'm really glad you're here.
Well, listen, she's vacationing in Belize, and I'd much rather be where she is. No offense.
I think we both agree on that. We're both jealous.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, first and foremost, I have to ask you how you're feeling. You're recovering from COVID. This is like day two out of COVID jail, right?
It is day two out of COVID jail, and it's nice to be out and about in society. I am wearing a mask here with your technician and my team, so we're being safe. But I feel much better. That's the good news. I've improved significantly. Sunday, Monday were rough days, but I've been improving every day and feeling much better about life. And it's great to be out of the basement.
You spent a lot of time covering the initial crisis of COVID-19 as Lieutenant Governor at the time and in charge of the task force. Do you have any new insights now that you yourself have had the virus in light of everything you've been through?
Well, of course, it's really interesting having talked about it, you know, worked on it, dreamt about it every day for over 2 years to finally get the virus. I think everybody gets their turn. I'm very, very grateful that we do have vaccines and medications and that we know so much more about the virus now. I can't imagine what it was like for people who got the disease in the earliest days, stages of the virus. Certainly parts of it hit me, and it affects everyone a little differently. The worst part for me was a sore throat, kind of worse than I'd ever had before, making it almost impossible to swallow. That was certainly tough, and gave me more empathy for people that have suffered through this and gone through it. But I'm of course one of the lucky ones, knowing what we know and being in a good spot and getting through this fairly rapidly without too many issues. The isolation piece is almost as hard as the illness itself, and certainly that's been hard on people who have had to isolate, away from loved ones and colleagues, and so that to me, I think, was the most difficult piece. Just being away as somebody who is engaged every day, probably over engaged in work and people that I associate with, and certainly we were able to connect now via the internet, and I was still able to work while I was stuck in the basement, but it's different, and I'm thankful to be on this side of it.
Did you have to do the thing we all had to do, where you sleep in the basement, your wife's upstairs, you're trying to keep the kids separate?
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. So I've been down in the basement, and we're lucky to live in a place that has a basement available. My wife's been sleeping upstairs. My daughter did also get the virus and symptoms, and so by day two, I at least had some company down there with me for most of the day. which was nice. But my wife and my boys did not get it. So we're two out of five that are living together right now that ended up testing positive.
Daddy-daughter quarantining.
It was, yeah.
It's what we do.
We got to know each other very well. Yeah. So it was a good chance for us to catch up.
It sounds like a lot of fun. Okay, Governor, we need to take some questions now. We have KSL listeners standing by on the line. I want to ask you first and foremost, you just celebrated 500 days in office with Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson. A two-part question for you to start. What is your administration's biggest accomplishment in those 500 days? And then I won't let you off the hook on this one. What is something you thought you'd have done by now that you haven't?
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful question. And no one's actually asked me for the biggest accomplishment. We're very proud of so many of the accomplishments and promises that we've made and that we've been able to follow through on. I guess I would have to say that, as hard as it is to narrow it down to one, this is actually one that wasn't on my radar when I took office, but came on my radar very quickly. And that is, the work around water conservation. We realized fairly soon after taking office when the snow did not develop the way we had hoped in January and February, and then heading into March, April, and May, that things were drier than we could have imagined, and that most of the state was in not just severe drought, but exceptional drought, which is the highest drought category, that we were going to have to move very quickly, and that it was going to take a real paradigm shift for all of Utahns. And we're going to have to convince 3 million of us that this is real and it's serious, and we all have to do something about it. And then convince the legislature to take some big swings, to make some big changes and really focus on conservation in a way that we haven't been able to do before. I'm just so grateful that the people of Utah responded, that the legislature responded. We passed a suite of bills, all focused around conservation, more conservation than we've ever tried in our state's history. And we're going to need it again this year. And so I guess that's, if I have to narrow it down to one, that's probably the one I'm most proud of, because it's such a big paradigm shift from where we've been to where we need to be, and people have come along. And again, I don't take credit for that. It's everyone that's really chipped in. There are some things that we haven't accomplished yet. And certainly, I had hoped that we would have gotten more funding for at-risk students and for optional all-day kindergarten. Those were a couple of the issues that we've been working hard on. The good news is that we were able to get some of that funding this last legislative session. We still have more to go, but that's been really important to me, making sure that every child in our state, regardless of zip code, has the same opportunities as other children, especially our kids in rural Utah and our kids living in some of our low-income neighborhoods along the Wasatch Front. I'm appreciative of the legislature for the additional funding we were able to get this year, and I anticipate we'll be able to get more next year as well.
Yeah, that funding really did get slashed in the middle of this session. Any reasoning behind that?
Well, it's a matter of priorities when it comes to funding, and there are so many competing priorities. And so I don't want to appear ungrateful. We were able to get a big chunk of that optional all-day kindergarten funding that we had hoped for. We didn't get all of it, but it's headed in the right direction. And so I don't want to, as I learned early in life, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. And the fact that we were able to get a piece of that shows a commitment, and I think bodes well for sessions to come.
I want to circle back to the conservation conversation after the break, but let's take a call right before we go to break here from James, who's in Colville. James, are you on the line with us? James, can you turn down your radio? There you go.
Yeah.
What's your question for the governor?
Okay, I just want to ask you about the time capsule yesterday set at the state capitol, Governor. I wasn't able to be there, but I've seen several similar ceremonies where the Masonic cornerstones or whatever. What were your thoughts on that? I think it's kind of neat to place the time capsule for future generations.
Yeah, James, thank you for the question. Yesterday was a special day here at the Capitol. We had a great ceremony. We had the Farmington High School band that was playing, and basically what we were doing is excuse me, we were trying to recreate the 1914 ceremony. And you're right, that was a cornerstone ceremony. It was Governor William Spry at the time who placed that cornerstone and placed the time capsule in the cornerstone. And the idea was that was supposed to be opened 100 years later. Well, 100 years later, we didn't know where the time capsule actually was. It had been cemented in such a fashion that we couldn't get to it. But they were able to use some technology to discover that there was a hole in the center of the cornerstone, and then they were able to use some drilling technology, some core drilling, to drill in there and remove a large sample of stone and find that there was indeed a void. And they put a camera in there and found that there actually was a time capsule in there. So they finished drilling the holes. We removed the time capsule. It was in 2016, so it's 2 years late. We got it out. We opened it up, and there were some newspapers and some letters and a program, some coins and some different things from 1914. And it was a really cool day for the state when Governor Herbert was able to open that. So we decided that we wanted to pay it forward, and that we would place a new box in that same opening. So we put it. It's an 8-inch by 12-inch by 16-inch box, and the historians have told us not to share all of the contents. We want to keep that vague so that future generations are surprised. But I can tell you that we've included newspaper clippings, books, videos, license plates, coins. I also wrote a personal letter to the governor of Utah in the year 2122, talking to him about what's happening here in the state now, 100 years before he will have opened this. And not just sharing the good things, although I did share the good things that are happening: the number one economy in the country, the fastest growing state in the nation, some really cool things that are happening here. But I also shared some of the challenges. I mentioned to them the drought that we're going through right now, and I mentioned some of the challenges we're having with inflation, especially the price of housing, and I mentioned the divisiveness that we're seeing in our politics across the country and even here in the state of Utah. And I pledged to them that we were going to do our part as leaders of the state to try to solve those problems so that their generations might be better off than we are. And of course, that future governor will get a chance to judge me and judge the legislature and leaders throughout the state. Hopefully we will have done them proud, and then I ask them to do the same, to pay it forward, that they would work hard not just for their own reelection or their own standard of living, but to really sacrifice for future generations. So I'm really hopeful that somebody will get that letter 100 years from now, and that Utah will still be the best place in the world. I told him, you know, we're number one for volunteerism and number one for charitable giving, and I hope it's still a great place like that, where we care about each other in the future. I'll just end with this. I did try to convince my staff to let me put in one of those spring-loaded snake in a can type things that pops out 100 years from now, but they talked me out of it. So they won't have a huge surprise when they open it in 2122.
You have smart people around you, Governor. I would not be impressed if that thing popped out at me. We are talking, obviously, with Utah's Governor Spencer Cox. This is Let Me Speak to the Governor. If you'd like to get your question on, you call 801-575-TALK or text your question to 57500. That's 801-575-8255, which is 801-KSL-TALK, or text your question to 57500. We'll take a break. More with the governor in just a minute.
I'm Dave Cauley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Get your questions answered by the governor. Call 801-575-8255 to join Let Me Speak to the Governor on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Let Me Speak to the Governor. Again, those numbers, 801-575-TALK, or you can text your question to 57500. We're speaking, of course, Utah's Governor, Spencer Cox. Governor Cox, let's talk water for a second. A legislative committee just gave a nod to this idea of piping water from the Pacific Ocean through California, through Nevada, literal pipeline to the Great Salt Lake. What do you make of this idea?
Well, it's a fascinating idea, and of course, I believe we should be looking at every idea when it comes to a drought in the West, not just in Utah, but across all of the Western United States. They're looking at it, of course, and they've given a nod to a study, and I have no problem whatsoever with studies. I think we should always be thinking big and bold. This one, of course, is interesting for lots of different reasons. One is just the enormity of it. Piping, it's one thing to pipe several hundred miles, of course, but also you're talking about a huge elevation change, so over 4,000 feet and through mountain passes, and that would take quite an engineering feat, and I can't even begin to imagine the billions of dollars of cost that it would take to get something like that, and the time frame it would take going through the environmental procedures and everything necessary to get a pipeline of that magnitude to the Great Salt Lake. So I've referred to it jokingly as a little bit of a pipe dream, but one that we're certainly worth looking at, and I'm always open to studies. But in the meantime, and in the short term for sure, our focus needs to be on the conservation piece and the part that all of us play, especially farmers like myself. And we have a huge program out there right now that got funded by the legislature that we're helping farmers upgrade their irrigation systems, implementing new technologies, which will significantly reduce the amount of water necessary to raise the same crops. And that's great news for all of Utah. And we're excited for those programs to be rolling out. So while I'm always interested in what a study might show, I'm more focused on the practical realities of today.
And it seems like we are hearing this message a lot. Conserve, conserve, conserve. We need people to conserve. We also need policies in place that incentivize and encourage water saving. And we have some of the rip up your strip kind of programs.
Yep.
Out there. We have money coming from the state budget to go to the Great Salt Lake. We saw some of this in the last session. Is this enough? What else should the state be doing? Can the state be doing besides preaching from the pulpit, if you will?
Yeah, well, we should be doing more, and those incentives that you talked about are really important, and we'll see. People ask me, is it enough? And I have to say, I don't know yet, because those laws are just now taking effect, right? So we have to wait and see what those new laws do. But what most of those laws do is they put in place programs, and new programs that will allow us to do more if the programs are working. So, for example, we became the first state in the nation to put in place a flip the strip program, a statewide program. That they've been done in other states at the community level, and a few communities here have done that as well. But we're the first one to have a statewide program to pay people, to give grants to people who want to remove grass and unnecessary grass and replace it with water-wise landscaping. Now we have $5 million for that. I'm hoping that's a drop in the bucket, that this program will be so popular that we'll need a lot more than that. But what we've put in place is the infrastructure that will allow us, if it works, to get more money from the legislature to do more of this. Same thing with agriculture. And so these are the programs I'm most hopeful for and most excited about. Just today, down in southern Utah, Washington City in Washington County are doing a big program. They're removing a significant amount of grass, and they'll have about 4 million gallons in water savings annually just from the effort today. And that's the type of thing that when it works, and other communities see it, realizing they can save money, they can save water. I think more and more communities are going to start implementing these programs, and that's good news for everyone.
What is your message to Utahns right now when it comes to water conservation?
Yes. Yeah, so the message is what we did last year, we have to do it again. And I'm so proud of the people who stepped up last year. Our reservoirs are at about 60% capacity right now. They were at 70% capacity at this time last year, and we just got our long-term forecast today. We get forecasts in two areas. One is a temperature forecast, and then one is a moisture water content forecast. And sadly, both of them came back as not good news for the summer months. So from now through August, what we're anticipating seeing is significantly above average temperatures and significantly below average precipitation. And so that's what we anticipate. And so it's important that we start now. For most of the state, this is really the first week where people needed to start watering their lawns. And again, for most of the state, one watering a week is enough. Just plan on having some brown spots, some yellow spots this year. We did this last year and we made it, and we're going to plan on it again. And then our farmers are going to have to cut back significantly, and they know that and they've been preparing for it.
Very good. Along the topic of water, we have a question from Kyle in Orem. And Kyle, I'm going to make sure, and Governor, I'm going to make sure too, we only have about a minute left before we have to go to the bottom of the hour news. So, Kyle, what's your question for the governor?
Thank you. My question is mostly about culinary water. I'm not concerned about watering the lawn, but at what point does our water conservation efforts require the limit of building permits? Because there are building and construction going on everywhere.
Yeah, Kyle, thank you. That's a great question. So one of the laws we passed this year was a law that requires municipalities to incorporate the availability of water with their planning for new permits. And so right now, most of our municipalities are okay when it comes to culinary water and the building that's happening right now. But there are some municipalities in southern Utah and others that now will be required as they're looking through this. They may need to cut back on the availability of permits in the short term because of a limit of water resources that are available. So that's a big change requiring that. Now, all the good mayors and city council members were doing this anyway, but there were several who weren't looking forward like that, and we've got to do that more, and that will now be happening.
Governor, thank you. 801-575-TALK is the number. If you have a question for the governor, you can text your question to 57500. This is Let Me Speak to the Governor, taking Governor Spencer Cox's answers to your questions and ours over the next half hour. We'll do bottom of the hour news and come back with more with Governor Spencer Cox.
This hour, it's Let Me Speak to the Governor. Governor Spencer Cox answers questions from KSL and from you. Call now, 801-575-8255. Let Me Speak to the Governor, live from the studios of KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
And I'm Lindsay Ertz, filling in for the vacationing Maria Chaleos this week. Governor Spencer Cox with us on the line, of course. Governor, I want to jump out to this question about this land swap situation. A legislative committee just approved this land swap deal with the federal government. The state's going to give up some land within Bears Ears National Monument in exchange for land in other parts of the state. Basically, this land is owned by our trust, right, which is required to develop for use for economic use, and then it gives that money to public and higher education uses. So basically, the thought here is that land inside Bears Ears isn't generating much revenue, so if this trust can own it, this will help them generate more money for the state. But the representative down in San Juan County, he's not on board with this. Representative Phil Lyman thinks there's so much little private land as it is. Do you support this land swap? Will you sign off on it with the Secretary of Interior so the deal can head to Congress?
Sure. Yeah. So it's something that we're still evaluating and looking at, but generally this will be a good deal for the citizens of the state and for the kids in the state. The question has always been, is there an impact with potential litigation down there? What I can say is that this is the same process that happened actually with the Grand Staircase issue many years ago, a couple decades ago. And what we were able to do as a state, you mentioned these trust lands. So when Utah became a state, there were portions of the state, these sections of land all throughout the entire state, this checkerboard, that were set aside in trust for the school kids of the state of Utah. And any development that happens on those lands, whatever that is, oil and gas development, housing development, grazing of animals, that money goes into a fund, and then the interest on that fund can be used for and divvied out to the school kids, to our school districts throughout the state. And it never really did much. And then finally, as a state, several years ago, we got smart about it, and we started being really strategic about how we develop these lands and where they are and the revenue that comes from those. And And now we have over $2 billion set aside. And again, the interest from that $2 billion then gets used every year for our school districts. And it's made a big impact. And so we're constantly trying to grow that. So the idea here is that that we'll trade the land that got locked up inside of Bears Ears, because now there's no value at all to it. If we can trade that out for parcels of land on, say, BLM land in the Uinta Basin with oil and gas reserves, or in some county next where there's major development happening, then we can generate even more money for those school kids. So overall, it's a positive. It's a net positive for the state. But certainly, we're going to want to look at that, exactly what it means and what it means for future litigation.
Do you have any response on whether you will sign off on that? The deal, you have to sign off, right, so the deal can head to Congress.
Yeah, I would say it's very likely, but we're still in the evaluation process.
All right, very good. Let's take a call right now. Let's go to Carol in Salt Lake City. She has a question about UTA. Carol, what's your question for the governor?
Hi, Governor. This is Carol. Why can't the government have more control over UTA's unilateral changes on routes and schedules that result in negative community effect? We in the avenues are experiencing an August 1st implementation of a change in routes that go by busy pedestrian and pet traffic areas. We are seeing an increasing frequency of an every 15-minute bus running through our quiet communities. We have a duration now of buses going from 4 a.m. to 12 midnight. The changes that are implementing were not communicated to the public. The Salt Lake City Community Council nor the Greater Avenues Community Council knew about them. We have been in contact with the Board of Trustees of the UTA, Derek Kitchen, Jennifer Provost, Todd Weiler, Chris Wharton, Gwen Springmeyer, Benjamin Witt from City Weekly, other media, Matt Gebhardt, and yourself, and Lieutenant Governor. And all we are being told, if we even get an answer, is that UTA is governed by themselves through their own councils. The question is, why can't the government have more control over UTA?
Yeah, Carol, thank you for that question, and it's a question I've gotten a lot as governor, and certainly UTA as the Mass Transit Association for the Wasatch Front, it is governed by its own board, and it is comprised of the different municipalities and the counties that have come together to create this transit district, and the state does not govern UTA. However, we are always getting more and more pressure to be more involved in the governance of UTA. And I think it's important to try to find the right balance there. And certainly I understand your concerns, and that can be very frustrating. Making sure that we get transit in the right places at the right times is a very difficult proposition. And I know that the folks at UTA are working hard to try to get those answers right. And I apologize that you and your community have some disagreements about what's happening there. I will tell you, not that this answers your question, but there was an effort that I supported this year to give the state a little more authority over one portion of UTA, and that is the oversight of major transit projects. So when we're talking about investing significant dollars, and including state dollars, in major projects, so this would be more like the expansion of light rail or new bus routes, those types of things. The Utah legislature passed a bill that will transfer the oversight of those transit projects from UTA to the Department of Transportation. And the idea behind that was to allow the state to invest more funds and make sure that we're coordinating between UDOT, the Department of Transportation, and UTA, so that when we're building or expanding freeways, we know where the transit projects are happening, and we coordinate those and maybe not build or expand freeways, but instead invest in expanding UTA in the right areas, so that they have a good working relationship. I know that doesn't exactly get to where you are, and I apologize that I don't have a better answer than the answer that you've just received, and that is that I have no authority to tell them where to send buses at what times and where not to. But what I will say is that the transit districts, because they are governed by the municipalities and the broader counties, they do have some authority there to influence those discussions, at least broadly, And so reaching out to your mayor and city council members and county council members, that is the appropriate place to go, as well as the UTA board.
Thank you, Carol, for your question. 801-575-TALK is the phone number to call, or you can text your question at 57500. Governor, let's go to our text line. A question now. What are you going to do to create conditions that support young families being able to purchase their first home in Utah?
Yeah, that's one of the things that keeps me up at night to the texter, and I'm deeply concerned about that piece of it. The inflation that we're seeing, especially in housing, is significant. I will say that we passed several bills trying to deal with that very issue this session. Again, those are just going into effect now, so it's going to take some time for those to work through. There's a couple pieces of this. So it's very simple economics. It's supply and demand. There's a significant demand right now for housing, and the supply is not keeping up with the demand. And so we just have to have more supply, and that means more housing. It does mean more density in some places, and too many people that want a place for their kids and grandkids to live also don't want density in their neighborhoods or in their cities. And that's where I say there has to be a balance, and we have to be smart about it. You don't put density just anywhere. There's good density and bad density. And one of the laws that we've worked on is to require density in places where there is mass transit, where there is an ability to have more people and not significantly impact the quality of life with transportation and other issues, because we have the infrastructure in place. And so you're going to see that. You will see more density coming in some areas, and we're going to be supportive of rolling back government regulations that prevent housing. One of the other interesting things that we have not dealt with, but that we're having a conversation about, is this idea of VRBOs and Airbnbs. And look, I've been very supportive of Airbnbs, but one of the reasons that housing is more expensive is that we've turned some of our housing supply, probably about 20,000 units in the state, into hotels. When you take a house off the market for a family to live in and say we're going to use it for short-term rentals, and I love them, by the way. I mean, my family, we rent them. We love the short-term rentals when we go to St. George or other places. But now you've taken that out and made it a hotel, and now there's less supply, which means that the price is going to go higher. So if we had those 20,000 houses right now available for people to live in, the price would come down significantly. One of the things that so we're still having that conversation. Again, I don't know where that will end up, but I just want to throw it out there. The last thing I'll say is we did make a change last year, and that change is to allow for accessory dwelling units across the state. And that means that there were many municipalities who refused to allow accessory dwelling units. So these are units attached to a house, basement apartments that could house new families, right? I mean, my wife and I, we rented one of these when we were in Logan, and lots of families do to get started. And we're hoping that there will be a significant increase in these accessory dwelling units, which will allow for new homeowners or new renters to come in and get their feet on the ground, and again increase supply there to reduce the price of housing, and then eventually get into a home on their own. So there are lots of things in play right now, and we're hoping that this mix and more to come will help to lower those prices.
We're talking with Governor Spencer Cox, of course, Utah's governor, during Let Me Speak to the Governor. 801-575-TALK is the phone number to call, 801-575-8255, if you have a question for the governor. Or you can text your question to 57500. We'll take a break. More with the governor in just a minute.
Get your questions answered by the governor. Call 801-575-8255 to join Let Me Speak to the Governor on KSL News Radio.
And I'm Lindsay Ertz, filling in for Maria Chaleos today in our final segment here with Governor Spencer Cox. Governor, we have primary elections coming up. We just spent as a legislature $500,000 to add video surveillance to the drop boxes in Utah this year. I've done a lot of reporting on Utah's elections and the security around them. Do you see this as a necessary security fix? And as you spend time as Lieutenant Governor, you know the ins and outs of Utah's election system. Are there other areas where you see we actually need more election security in Utah?
Well, I think, look, every year we when I was Lieutenant Governor and now with Lieutenant Governor Henderson, we helped to run legislation through through the legislature to help improve security around elections, and I'm very proud of what we've been able to accomplish. We have no evidence of any mass voter fraud in the state at all. And certainly this is one area where, well, we don't have any reason to suspect that any of our drop boxes were ever compromised. That's just not a thing. It doesn't hurt at all to have some video surveillance to make sure that that doesn't occur in the future. And so I think whenever we get an opportunity like this to just enhance and improve the security, we should take it, and we did. And I thought the bills that we passed this year around election security were good bills, and so we should always be working to make sure our elections stay secure.
Very good. Let's go to the phone lines now. John is in Ogden. Oh, it looks like John is not there anymore. Let's go to let's go to Carice in Clearfield. She has a question about low income housing development. Carice, are you with us?
Yes, I am, but I'm a he, not a she.
Oh, please excuse me. What's your question for the governor?
So my question revolves around the fact that as we're looking at this housing crisis and the immediate need to try to get people, you know, a place to stay, the people who are around the, you know, the 60% median income level in their counties, they're being left behind at market rate housing. What can we do, you know, to get more cities involved in partnering with not only just the Lynn Walker Institute, or maybe even with help from the legislator, on getting some of more of this type of development built across the Wasatch Front?
Yeah, Carice, thank you for that question, and thank you for your service up in northern Utah. We're grateful to have public servants like you who are interested in this issue and are working to help make sure that we're helping prevent homelessness and get people housed as quickly as we can. So, you know, the last answer I was talking about new families looking to buy homes and get housing. What you're referring to are kind of the super low income area, and we were fortunate to get a significant amount of money, around $50 million from the legislature to the deeply affordable housing, and again that money is just now becoming available as we enter the new fiscal year, the 1st of July, and we'll be partnering with communities and with the Olin Walker Housing Fund and others to develop that type of ultra affordable housing, and that's being coordinated right now. We're very fortunate to have former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, who is working to coordinate all of these issues around affordable housing and homelessness, and so we're very optimistic. We had asked for $100 million, we only got half that, but it's the most we've ever gotten, and so it's a great start, and we're open and willing to work with any community that has interest in helping us develop that type of housing for people that need it.
Governor, a question from the text line at 57500. A texter wants to know, with recent gun crimes occurring across the country, do you regret any of the bills you have signed, and specifically the one allowing constitutional carry?
I don't regret signing that bill. That's certainly not the case. That's not what happened with these latest gun violence incidents. I do have deep regret for what's happening in our country and the terrible violence, especially referring, I think the one that's top of mind for most of us is the terrible supermarket shooting in New York, in Buffalo, and the fact that was racially motivated, it's disgusting and it's just wrong, that you know, he used a weapon that was illegally modified to accomplish that tragedy, and so that is again an illegal act, and it's terrible, and it can't happen. And so my heart is broken for those people. I feel good about the laws we have on the books here in the state of Utah, and giving people an opportunity to defend themselves in case there is something like that happens, a sick mass murderer like that person in that supermarket.
Governor, you mentioned earlier today that there may be a global food shortage crisis on the horizon. I'm curious to know how that impacts Utah. And then I'm going to ask you a separate kind of unrelated question, but having to do with shortages as well. A texter is also asking about the statewide concrete shortage. Can you kind of speak to both of those shortage aspects?
Yeah, so certainly on the global food side, unfortunately, about 25% of the wheat production in the world comes from Ukraine and Russia, and you know, we know what's happening there, and that's going to have a huge impact on global wheat supply. Also, China has had a bad wheat crop this year, and they're the biggest producer of wheat. And so any time something like that happens globally, we live in a global society, and whether we like it or not, it's going to impact prices here at home. And so I suspect that on top of the inflation we're already seeing, that we will see additional inflation when it comes to food. And supply chains are breaking down for lots of reasons. One, because of the war in Ukraine. Two, because of energy prices. Three, because of China and their zero COVID policy, which has been a terrible decision and really disrupted supply chains recently. And sadly, we're far too reliant on China for far too much. I just led a trade delegation to Mexico in which many Utah businesses were looking to take jobs and production from China and move it to Mexico or the United States here in North America, which would be much better for consumers and much better for the companies themselves. And so when you add all on top of that, the money that the federal government has put into the system, that's where we're seeing the increased demand. And that's why things like concrete, we're seeing a reduction in supply because there's so much building going on right now. So we have so much demand for housing and a shortage of supplies coming in different areas. And that's led to this perfect storm where we are seeing so much inflation right now. And we're working hard to try to arrest that inflation.
And then as far as the concrete shortage, is that something Utahns need to worry about?
Yeah, well, it's just that there's so much building going on right now. Now, the rise in interest rates that the Fed is pushing is going to destroy demand as fewer people can afford a loan now to buy houses or build houses. That's going to, over time, that will help with concrete supply and supply of everything else, but at the cost of destruction demand. And so that's not a great thing, but certainly we will see those prices come down over time.
And, Governor, I will give you 30 seconds to answer this. Team Donovan or Team Rudy?
Team Jazz. That's the answer.
Always
I love both.
The politician.
Well, no, it's not politician. It's real. They're both incredibly talented. I know both of them. We're fortunate to have two superstars here in Utah, two perennial all-stars here, and I would hate to lose either of them.
Governor Spencer Cox with us on Let Me Speak to the Governor over the last hour. Thank you, Governor, for your time, for answering some tough questions for us and for our KSL listeners for texting and calling in as well. Governor Cox will be back with us next month.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.